The coronavirus pandemic will be studied for decades. What we did right, what we did wrong, what we can do better next time, symptoms, treatments, preventions, how COVID works, how it spreads, how it mutates. That's what the doctors, epidemiologists, researchers, and public health officials will be trying to figure out. But the sociologists, anthropologists, environmentalists, and every other ologist will also be hard at work as we, hopefully, start to see COVID through the rearview mirror. There are a few silver linings. Without so many tankers and cruises, the oceans are much quieter, so whales are behaving the way they would without human beings invading their space. There are fewer planes dumping CO2 into the atmosphere. The crime rate is down, and so are car accidents. But there are far more dark clouds. Unemployment, hunger, school closures, evictions, and disparities in healthcare and outcomes. Today on Rising to the Challenge, we look at some of the side effects of the coronavirus. Increased food insecurity and a UIC food pantry that's providing fresh food for Chicago's Southside residents. More single-use items in the waste chain and a UIS professor who can tell us what we can do about it. New course offerings like engineering in an emergency. And, for a nice change of pace, a visit to a horse farm, where they, too, had to do some fast COVID thinking.
The mystery virus started here in the city of Wuhan. Chinese authorities pinpointing its source to this food market. Those infected are being treated in medical centers, suffering symptoms similar to pneumonia.
We're deeply concerned both by the alarming levels of spread and severity and by the alarming levels of inaction. We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic.
I think Americans should be prepared that they're going to have to hunker down significantly more than we as a country are doing.
Right now, we turn to alarming numbers in the coronavirus pandemic. Those numbers have set records.
The rising number of cases and hospitalizations in many areas are still mounting.
Coronavirus cases continue to climb. Separately, the CDC says it's possible that the number of infections in the U.S. could be 10 times higher than the confirmed case count.
At the rate Americans are dying from COVID in a week or maybe less, we'll likely reach the 250,000 mark. And while not all will get sick, plenty will and plenty are, leaving some hospitals looking more like disaster relief centers.
This is a make or break moment for Illinois.
A few years ago, UIC family physician Dr. Evelyn Figueroa had a kind of a revelation.
I really thought that I was knowledgeable and I was one of the good guys. I thought that I was this doctor who would always go the extra mile for her patients. I would go to the pharmacy and pay for things. I was a super strider for AIDS Walk. I really did feel like I was on the good side, and I wasn't. I was complicit, and I didn't know I was complicit. I was approaching things through a lens of charity and not through solidarity.
The catalyst for her philosophical overhaul was an experience she had with one of her patients. Prior to this, she, like many of us, thought that the profiles of people experiencing homelessness were mostly single men.
I recognized in 2017 that I had a patient that was experiencing homelessness that I had taken care of on and off for 2 years while taking care of her child, and I'd completely missed it. I would see her through the residence. She had all the risk factors, but she was a law student. Because she was a law student, something made me think that the rest of her risk factors, you know, vanished. And after seeing her completely in shambles one day in clinic and figuring out that she was escaping a violent partner by sleeping on her mother's couch, which is, you know, housing insecurity, I decided I would talk to patients a lot differently, and so I did.
Thus, Dr. Figueroa began a transformation that started with patient care.
So one of the adaptations I did was asking people a lot about where they were staying rather than, do you have somewhere to live? That's a very different question. I asked people if they had access to books. And then the last thing was that I, instead of asking, are you eating healthy? I started asking, do you have access to fruits and vegetables, fresh fruits and vegetables? And I got, it went 180 degrees.
Dr. Figueroa decided that if her patients couldn't get healthy foods, she would bring healthy foods to her patients. The best way to do that, she decided, was to open a food pantry. And against all odds, she did. The Pilsen Food Pantry opened on January 2, 2018, in a medical clinic at the university. They had two offices, one freezer, and no money.
It's a hustle. Getting food is a huge hustle. We ran without a paid employee for the first 8 months of operations. I basically burnt every bridge that I had with all of my friends and worked some manic hours trying to support this. My children are the indentured servants of the pantry. A lot of folks asked the first year, why would a family doctor want to do something like this? And I would always say, but why wouldn't a family doctor want to do this?
The pantry thrived for over 2 years in the medical clinic, cramped though it was. Then it moved to a decommissioned church in the Pilsen neighborhood of Chicago, and then COVID hit. Before COVID, people could walk right into the pantry and alongside a volunteer take what they needed. Now, however, people have to fill out a form, wait outside while a volunteer fills it, and then wheels the grocery cart outside for pickup. But the pandemic has affected a lot more than just logistics.
The food insecurity rate has gone up 50% since COVID. The COVID pandemic hit the United States, but prior to that, one in eight American families was food insecure. One in nine American families. It was twice as high in Black and brown families.
The 50% rise in need translated to feeding 350 to 400 more families a month. That's 20 to 24,000 more pounds of food to be processed and distributed. And suddenly, fresh fruits and vegetables were harder to find because grocery stores were also suffering. Since then, supplies have bounced back, but there's an ebb and flow to awareness. After George Floyd was murdered, donations and volunteers poured in. Then it slowed. Around the holidays, they see another bump, and then another slowdown.
This is not a new problem. It's an exacerbated problem, but this exists. So I hope that people, after Thanksgiving, after the new year, will keep remembering.
Fortunately, so far, none of the staff or volunteers have tested positive. Like food insecurity, COVID in some parts of the city remains invisible to other parts of the city.
The COVID belt starts in Pilsen and just spreads until it gets past Midway. Like it's like on every map. And of course, Belmont Craig in the southeast part of the city too. But these are huge areas. These are families that are essential workers. So getting paid minimum wage, doubling up in their families, really unable to shield themselves, and yet some of our neighborhoods are not considered as in crisis.
The crisis has spilled out onto the streets, particularly over the past few months when no one can go inside to get services or they have to go inside a few at a time. When the pantry was in the medical clinic, it was small and cramped, but it was also warm and easily accessible.
The nice thing about having it against a clinic is that it's incredibly destigmatizing. You can see what it looks like today with COVID, people standing outside. And that's what clinics look like. You can guess what clinics are for. If it's a Salvation Army and there's a line outside, it's for food. If it's a wellness center, it's for methadone. You can guess. You have these people standing outside, waiting for things, very stigmatizing, really introducing a lot of bias towards poverty. And we didn't want that. So our original location had a heated waiting room, and it was just incredibly integrated. There was a window.
But the space the pantry occupied in the clinic was needed for COVID testing. Finding a new space, moving the pantry, and growing it to the size it is now was no small feat. But when Dr. Figueroa, who has four children, hatches a plan of how she can make a difference, she cannot be stopped. Good thing she and her husband, Dr. Alex Wu, also a physician in family medicine, are two birds of a feather. Between them, they have championed maternal health care, health disparities that negatively affect people of color, vulnerable population care, and various areas of health equity and social justice. They've been together 6 years, and despite the very heavy lift that this pantry requires in time, money, and stress...
We're still married.
You're still married? Exactly. And it sounds like a recipe for a great story later or disaster.
My husband's been in safety net medical care his whole career. He's a family doctor, too. So our values are basically identical, even though we grew up in different parts of the country and in different cultures. We're incredibly aligned. Like, we're just people that if we're sitting down, we don't feel useful.
I'm not sure they ever do sit down, or, for that matter, sleep.
So this is the Pilsen Food Pantry. So we have a loop.
After 2 years of keeping it all together with grit, spit, and determination, now the pantry has 4 paid staffers, a slew of volunteers, including her medical students, 13 refrigerators, and lots of beautiful, fresh food.
And then this is mainly produce on the right side, mainly dairy on the left side.
Wow, so there's packed salads. I'm just like overwhelmed by the amount of the variety of stuff you've got.
Yeah.
Just that's visible. There's packed salads. I can smell the basil. Yes. Eggs, cheese, every kind of produce. Yeah, milk, yogurt.
Yeah, we go to great lengths to source the food.
The food comes like from 3 major suppliers. The Greater Chicago Food Depository, a federal program that donates milk, meat, dairy, and those kinds of staples, Imperfect Produce, which donates a lot of fruits and vegetables, and Trader Joe's, which donates lots and lots of things from soup to nuts. In fact, they make 40 runs to Trader Joe's every month. And then there are the non-food items.
So menstrual hygiene kits, adult diapers, baby diapers, toothbrushes, toothpaste, baby food, formula we have right now, pet food. We give away school supplies every year. We're just trying to, if there's something that we can give that will offset another expense in the house, it's just a way to help folks be able to have more agency with their own finances. Try to think about just helping people feel as normal as possible. Just because you're food insecure doesn't mean you don't enjoy flowers, doesn't mean you might not want to dye your hair once in a while. Like, these are all things that we take for granted.
What started out as a small pantry is now basically a community center that offers an ever-growing array of wraparound services and is a hopping place. But the decommissioned church had been vacant for a long time, so the windows need replacing and the lights need repair. It's drafty and cold. But that is hardly a stumbling block for Dr. Figueroa. Feeding people is only the first step in offering more holistic care to people in this community. The Pilsen Food Pantry is now part of a bigger vision, the Pilsen Social Health Initiative, where Dr. Figueroa has a social work intern, a volunteer physical therapist, a medical supply closet, housed in the confessional of the church, no less, volunteer lawyers, a food delivery program, and cooking and nutrition classes. And she still has more plans in store. She wants to get Wi-Fi computer access stations to help families for whom connectivity is a problem and convert the church sanctuary into a multi-purpose space. The Pilsen Social Health Initiative, as she named it, is becoming such a big project, Dr. Figueroa may have to step away from one of her favorite parts of her job, delivering babies. But she feels the trade-off is worth it.
I think it's important for physicians to be part of their resistance and part of advocating for stronger ties to social services through medical care. I think we all need to be way more literate at navigation. This is not a social worker's job. This is everybody's job.
Dr. Evelyn Figueroa, professor and doctor of family medicine at the University of Illinois Chicago and co-director of the Figueroa Wu Family Foundation. One of the academic side effects of the COVID crisis is a change up in course offerings. You may have heard about courses potentially on the chopping block at various schools, but perhaps you haven't heard about unique classes that may be added to the roster, classes that wouldn't be offered if it weren't for COVID. One that's being tossed around at UIUC is Engineering in an Emergency. But don't take my word for it. The story begins back when so much started to change last March.
My name is Bill King. I'm a professor of mechanical science and engineering in the Granger College of Engineering at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. So in mid-March, the University of Illinois was contacted by Carle Health, our local hospital system. Carle was planning for a worst-case scenario where there were potentially hundreds or even thousands of people in our community who would need a ventilator and it would not be available. We gathered a team of about 50 people from the university, from Carle Health Hospital System, and from some local businesses. This was a team of about 50 people consisting of engineers, designers, physicians, and we got together to see, could we come up with something that would solve the problem? We chose an emergency ventilator. An emergency ventilator is a mechanical device. It has just a few dozen components. Almost all of them are made out of plastic. It's relatively low cost because of its simplicity and the low cost of the materials. It's about the size of three coffee cups, smaller than a loaf of bread. We got our team together on a Sunday afternoon in mid-March. It was the first meeting of our team. We organized into sub-teams, we broke the problem down into components, and we worked night and day for about a month. We had our first working prototype within a week of that very first meeting, which was extraordinary. If you had asked me, can you have a working prototype within a week? I would have said, that's not possible. I'm not gonna sign up for that. I can't wait to see the movie version. It was stressful. At the end of the first week, a couple of our team members were in the laboratory and they did some functional testing and they took a video of the working emergency ventilator connected to a test lung, a synthetic test lung. And we saw the test lung cycling on its own, powered by an air supply, just as it would be in a hospital setting. And it was extraordinary. I don't think there was a dry eye on the whole team. After we had made our first prototypes and tested them in the laboratory, we realized that we had the designs for a working emergency ventilator. And in the middle of the pandemic, that's a potentially very valuable thing. What we decided to do was to make the designs and all the test information available for free. And that information is available now from the university under a free license that any organization or company can come and get access to that information. As of today, we've had more than 70 organizations that have licensed that technology, and they're from all over the world, more than 15 countries. As of today, there are two companies that have announced that they are bringing to market emergency ventilators based on the Illinois rapid vents. One company, Aquis in India, has announced that they are delivering 2,000 emergency ventilators to hospitals in India. A second company, Belkin, has announced that they're bringing an emergency ventilator to market based on the Illinois rapid vents, and we expect that to come out soon. There's a group of us at the university that are thinking about how we can turn what we've learned and also what's going on elsewhere in the world about the pandemic, how can we turn those things into educational offerings? So we're thinking about, what does it mean to do engineering in an emergency? How do you think about designing something where there is risks of acting, but then also risks of not acting? We're thinking about a class, we're thinking about emergency hackathons, where we bring people in that want to have an immersive experience where they practice designing in an emergency, and then turn that into, you know, a learning experience for them as well.
Bill King, professor of mechanical science and engineering in the Granger College of Engineering at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. As we explore the ripple effects of the pandemic, it's hard not to think about all the new COVID waste out there. It might surprise you to know, then, that in some respects, we manage our waste too well.
I always like to say that the United States overall has a very effective waste management system, in that it is invisible to most of us.
In other words, it's not that we don't have a pollution problem. It's that we flush it, truck it, or export it out of sight. And when it's out of sight, it tends to be out of mind. And when it's out of mind, let's face it, we forget about it.
My name is Anne Marie Hansen, and I am an associate professor of environmental studies at the University of Illinois Springfield.
I'm at Professor Hansen's house in Springfield during the brief window when her kids were in school to talk about the unintentional side effects COVID has had on our air, land, and water. Some of it's good, and we'll get to that in a bit. But as you can imagine, most of it, not so good. Think gloves, shields, and masks, masks, masks.
There's about a 600% increase in the production of plastics used for medical single-use plastics. There was a study done in the UK that was estimating that if everyone in the UK used a single a disposable mask every day for a year, that would end up being like 60 to 70,000 extra tons of disposed plastic every year. And just in the UK.
And where do we put all of that extra non-recyclable waste? It has to be incinerated or put in landfills. The problem with incinerators is we don't have enough of them. And the problem with landfills is...
we have about 20 years left of landfill capacity in the state. Some places, like they're going to have to close their landfill in 4 years because it will be filled to capacity and it will have to be covered.
Another worry Professor Hansen points to is our renewed dependence on single-use plastics, like the aforementioned masks and the plastic bags at the grocery store. It took decades to train people not to use them, to bring their own reusable bags to the store, and now we're right back to where we started.
I think the average lifespan of a single-use plastic bag is 15 minutes. Generally, you put something in it and you bring it to where you're going, and then you're done with it.
Not only are people using the plastic grocery bags again, but there's a danger that they'll start to equate, quote, the safer option with the plastic bag, even after COVID has come and gone. Bag bans have been lifted, bag fees have been suspended, and we're all quick to go back to bad habits. The pandemic has also encouraged other bad habits waste-wise, like far more online purchases that generate far more packaging waste, and takeout food orders that generate styrofoam, straws, and plastic clamshells. If we think all of these polluting habits are keeping us safer at this very uncertain time, will we ever want to give them up? It's all a little depressing.
You have to be optimistic. You have to be, if you're an environmental scientist, especially if you work on issues of sustainability or sustainable development, you can't work in those areas if you are a pessimist, that you think nothing will ever get better.
The key to reversing some of these problems is to make our waste seem less like waste and more like a valuable commodity, turning it into something we can use. That's not a new idea. Recycling has been with us a while. But if we can really pull it off this time on a bigger scale, it's a win-win, since it not only reduces waste, but creates jobs as well.
Out of 1,000 pounds of materials, you can have what would be 0.1 job in Illinois. If that was all that material was doing was going to a landfill. But if we were diverting that to other types of reuse, including things like composting, green materials, or recycling or things, we could have a range of 4 to 10 jobs per 1,000 pounds of materials.
In order for any of that to happen, waste management has to catch up with the rest of environmental science in quantifying the problem. And that is a little easier said than done.
Waste management has always been behind other types of management. They haven't capitalized on the growth in smart technology sectors or big data sectors. So for example, we can have real-time data on air pollution or water stream flows or how much, you know, you can even find COVID in wastewater. But we have very limited forms of data available when we're working in waste management. One of the challenges is when something shifts, like the waste management and waste patterns have shifted so much, it's hard to see how can we fix this for the better in the future, because it was already something where the data was very limited.
So here's where the good part comes in. And there are some reasons to be optimistic. Think of all the large gatherings that aren't generating garbage and waste. Sporting events, concerts, festivals, and even weddings. And the planes that aren't flying in the sky. That's something. But, sorry to go back to the negative just 4 sentences after talking about the positives. Because then again, we wouldn't be in this pandemic mess in the first place if we didn't obliterate biodiversity and destroy animal habitats, because that is how viruses jump from animals to people.
It would be better if we could specifically make it easy for the public to understand that the broad biodiversity loss and habitat destruction can directly be linked to something like coronavirus. If when we're reducing biodiversity, whether it's in a very localized area or globally, we're reducing nature's capacity to rebound from a risk, right? And humans, don't forget that we are part of nature.
To that end, Professor Hansen is part of a new project across the U of I system to broadly improve our environmental progress both during and after COVID. It's called Sustain MWM, which stands for Uncovering Strategies and Analytics in Material and Waste Management.
The goal is to use a team of interdisciplinary scientists to improve modeling and data analytics to help municipalities and the state strategically plan for more resilient systems, waste management systems, and also in particular to help so we can be better prepared for future shifts or future shocks in waste generation patterns.
Which honestly sounds a little dry, which points to another pet peeve of Professor Hansen. Waste has never really had very good PR. It's just not a very sexy subject, and people don't know how to make a difference.
Definitely in the pandemic, we see that need for communication, environmental communication, science communication, it's not that those who already work in these fields, they're many are doing a fabulous job. I think there's just many more scientists that see, oh my gosh, how their work could directly benefit people if it was communicated in a way that spoke to people effectively.
So maybe we'll soon see ads for waste management that are as catchy as, say, I'm loving it, or just do it. That would make Professor Hansen very happy. Until then, she and her colleagues will take what they're learning now to plan for the next pandemic or system disruption. Anne-Marie Hansen, Associate Professor of Environmental Studies at the University of Illinois, Springfield. Lots of young women have a thing for horses. I should know because I was one of them. They're beautiful, majestic, powerful, and gentle. Now that I'm a much older woman, I still love horses. I just don't get to hang out with them very much. But on a crisp fall morning, my producer Libby Foster and I headed down to the UIUC horse farm to check out a story about one COVID side effect that might surprise you. It has to do with pregnant horses, students in absentia, and technology. The horse farm might not be the first place you associate with technology as you look out among the green pastures, long fences, and gangly fillies and colts lazily munching on the grass. Most of the horses at the farm are standard-bred harness racers, and each year anywhere from 15 to 25 mares are bred, and each spring 15 to 25 foals are born.
So these are the babies. So these are all weanlings. So they have... About 2.5 weeks ago, they were weaned from their moms. They're getting used to being in their own little herd now. They're very independent.
Piper Bayansky is a senior at UIUC and kindly volunteered to show us around.
If they come up to you, like, please pet them, like, get them used to people. That's the goal right now, so.
I'm going to take them home.
I know, they're very cute.
These foals were born here just a few months ago. When 25 mares are scheduled to foal at about the same time, you need a lot of eyes and ears on them 24/7 to make sure everything goes according to plan. Normally, most of those eyes and ears belong to students who register for a very popular class aptly named Foal Watch.
Any student from any major, you can be undergraduate, graduate, you partake in 6 live shifts throughout the course of the semester, 6 to 8, depending on your credit hour. They're 6-hour shifts, and what you do is you come in from 6 p.m. to midnight or from midnight to 6 a.m., and you basically do walk-bys every 15 minutes to see if the mare's, you know, about to give birth or if she's having trouble. And if they just happen to get lucky and choose the right shift and it's a normal foaling and delivery, I'll throw them a towel and a pair of gloves and say, all right, you know, I need you to come help me with this. And the students are actually involved in a lot of that neonate care.
Molly Baldus is the manager of the Equine Research and Teaching Unit at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She was at a horse sale in Kentucky when we visited the farm, so we spoke with her, how else, on Zoom. When the campus emptied out last spring because of COVID,
it was pretty much the worst possible timing for the farm.
To understand just why the timing was so bad, you have to have some insider info about racehorses. No matter when in the calendar year they're born, their official birthday is always listed as January 1st.
So what that means is basically in a given calendar year, if you have a foal born in February and then you have a foal born in July, they're both considered the exact same age for records and racing purposes. Obviously, the one that's, you know, several months older is going to have the advantage. Most mares gestate for 343 days, so they're pregnant for about 11 months. Normally, though, the time that most of them are bred back and start to foal is, guess what, March and April.
And foaling isn't the only thing going on at the farm in the spring. Breeding activities, ultrasounds, neonatal care, and all of the other daily chores of life with horses, feeding, exercising, cleaning and brushing, and mucking out of stalls, just to name a few. And that doesn't even include care of the land, like weeding and fence fixing.
I had 8 staff members, 3 interns, we had 13 students in the breeding class, and we had, I think, 75 students lined up for the overnight foal watch shifts.
After COVID closed campus, they were down to 5 total.
So what did you do when everybody went home and you had 25 mares about to foal?
I panicked. I panicked for about 12 hours, and I have a really good supervisor, and he got me to calm down. But I did what a lot of people do in the modern age. I Amazoned. So I got online and found basically almost baby monitor cameras. And in this modern age that we live in, there was an app attached to them. So I emailed all the students and said, okay, plot twist. I need you all to download this app. You are going to now be responsible for checking these cameras from your phone, from the comfort of your own home.
And it's a good thing she came up with this low-tech, low-cost workaround.
Sometimes they did catch things. They're like, hey, you know, I think that mare laid on her baby. Oh, they were right. I ran over there and got the, you know, she had just kind of rolled over, I think, and I got the baby out before anything happened.
The beautiful foals born on the farm this spring were all hanging out, swatting flies with their tails, nipping at each other's rumps, and cautiously eyeing the people with masks and microphones that were hanging on the rail. They were also a little peckish. Piper Byansky slung a bucket of oats into the trough. While the foals jostled to establish their pecking order, eventually, after some nudging and shoving, they all got fed.
They're like toddlers right now, and how they feel around in the world is with their mouths. So, like, we'll be in there, and sometimes they'll, like, nibble on you a little bit, and then sometimes they'll accidentally bite you.
I consider those love nibbles. Now, despite the unusual circumstances this spring, with no students to watch the mares in person, all the foals were born healthy. They expected 25, they got 24. Molly Baldus explains that their record for the year is still perfect. It's just that one of the mares threw them a curveball.
We could have sworn she was in foal, and she was just fat. So I'm not going to let that ruin my record. But we did get 24 live births out of 24 in foal mares. And even on a normal, perfect season, that's not normal.
Also not normal? This mom and foal.
Mares normally gestate 343 days. This mare was 79 days. She was about a month over. So we checked her. The foal was fine. She showed no signs of distress. It was like 7 o'clock at night. A veterinarian was over doing some research, running some blood samples, and we had our foal watch coordinator was in the barn, I think checking the schedule. And between the three of us, when she reached in, the other vet, we managed to get the baby out. But when she reached in to pull his head around, she said, oh my gosh, he has teeth already.
Normally, a foal weighs between 130 and 150 pounds. This guy weighed 180. So they named him Big Time.
Like, I mean, he literally was a month old when he came out.
Now that the students are back on the farm, social distancing is easy in all this open space. They just have to stay one horse length away from each other. Hopefully, come next spring, students in the foal watch class will be able to spend their days and nights babysitting the pregnant mares. If not, baby monitor cameras will come out again. Not the same, sure, but potentially a lifesaver. Literally. In the meantime, the horses are happy and healthy and getting newly socialized to being around people, people who are wearing a lot of PPE.
You know, horses are prey animals, so I wasn't sure how they were going to handle seeing humans with masks and coveralls and rubber boots and gloves. I wasn't sure how they were going to take it. And as soon as they realized that all of that gear meant that they were going to get treats, every time they see students in gear now, they're like, yay, it's lab time.
Eventually, as much as I didn't want to, we had to leave the ponies. Piper Byansky showed us the way out. What she's seen on the farm has been a big factor in what she wants to study in vet school.
Obviously, this farm has like shown me like the opportunities and like from the stud side to the mare side. So I definitely am very interested in that now. So I would love to do large animal specialty and equine reproduction.
After we said goodbye to Piper, Molly, and the ponies, we got back in the car and back on the road. Our next stop was visiting Barry Hauser, director of the Marching Illini, U of I's marching band that, due to COVID, can neither march nor band. But that does not dampen their enthusiasm or their sound. You'll hear that story coming up on our sixth and final episode of Rising to the Challenge. Rising to the Challenge was produced and engineered by Libby Foster, with editing help from Shayna Roth. Special thanks to Tim Colleen, Moss Bresnahan, Lily Duncanson, Laura Clower, Robin Kaler, Kirsten Ruby, David Mercer, Gretchen Yorty, and Tom Hardy. Rising to the Challenge is a production of the University of Illinois System, with production support from Illinois Public Media. I'm Gwen Maxey. Thanks for listening.